Chapter 95.
This convocation is now in session, Iluxiat Amazal said. None may enter, none may leave.
Karis wondered if, out of all the Hyluxiats, they'd chosen Amazal solely for his voice. He had a great, booming, deep, powerful voice, maybe the voice and the beard. He had a braided beard in the Atashian style. It was enormous and perfectly white, woven with white silk thread and pearl beads. With a gravitas that imbued even simple actions with meaning, he held up the end of a thick iron chain. Half a dozen young Luxiats were holding coils and coils of the stuff. It was a single, long chain. Unhurriedly, he walked to the main doors and wrapped the chain around the handles, rattling and clanking. There was some sound there that set off Karis's blackguard senses, but maybe it was just thinking of Gavin being in such chains. Gavin, here, home again. Gavin, her love, perhaps broken. A young assistant brought Hyluxiat Amazal an enormous lock, and he snapped it on. He repeated this at each of the doors, unwinding the chain from each relieved young Luxiat's arms, walking to each, taking his time and winding the chain securely. By the time he reached the last door, the last assistant was trembling with fatigue. He was sweating, clearly terrified he would shame himself by dropping the chain. Finally, they came back up the side aisle, fully encircling the nobles and drafters seated in the audience hall. Karis realized she was supposed to be praying. She was off kilter still, seeing her son. Her son? Had been more of a shock than she'd thought it would be. He was staring at her, too. But he wasn't only staring, he was wearing a crown. Her son had been made Prism Elect. Karis hadn't imagined that Andros Gael would demand that a new Prism Elect be named, not while his own son was Prism. That would have meant a loss of power for his family. Unthinkable. Or at least it should have meant a loss of power for the Gaels. Karis knew Andros wouldn't have given such power to Kip. Andros didn't hold Kip, didn't control him. Not yet. Though no doubt he was working on that. But this was altogether unforeseen. A failure of intelligence, in both senses of the term. Andros had another guile in play. Zymon, and he'd kept him out of sight until the moment came to play him. Karis hadn't even known that Andros knew she had a son. He hadn't only known it, he'd insinuated himself into Zymon's life, somehow. The only thing worse than having to face her abandoned son was to face him after Andros had picked him up like an abandoned toy and taken ownership of him. She couldn't think about this now. She didn't even recognize this ceremony, and somehow she was sitting in the front row. Damn! Her whole side hurt from that idiotic dive into the water. Tomorrow she wasn't going to be able to get out of bed, she was sure of it. But sitting here in front, she couldn't even try to massage her shoulder. If only Lord Bran's Spreading Oak didn't like her so much. He was old now, but still perfectly genteel. She'd known the Spreading Oaks since she was a girl. Back then they'd had 6 sons. One had become a Prism, briefly. All were dead now, raiders, fever, the wars. When she was 12 and 13 years old, Lord Bran had hoped she'd marry his youngest, Gracos. He'd been a kind boy, more poet than warrior. He'd died a hero's death that had accomplished nothing in a battle that hadn't settled anything. Karis looked back to Zymon. She couldn't help it. Was there something about him that drew the eye, like iron to lodestone, or was it only her? No. No. He was very handsome. He was Prism Elect. Everyone was at least glancing at him frequently, but only Karis stared with her gut churning. She looked away to the other colours sitting on the platform with him. Dallara Orange looked sober for the first time in months that Karis could remember. Karis's eye was drawn to the two she didn't know, Kaelia Green and Kahan Sabred. The dwarf Kaelia Green of New Tyria seemed like she could be a natural ally. Gavin would need those in the days to come. Karis should have already made her acquaintance. Kahan Goldenbriar was the newest colour, stepping into Aris Sabred's place after she had died in childbirth. Kahan was a cousin of both Aris Greenvale and Ela Jorvis, and therefore to Anna Jorvis, whom Gavin had thrown off his balcony, albeit accidentally. If Caris had been looking for someone to look at who would set her mind at ease, she was looking in the wrong place. She looked back at Zyman. And away again. Dear Orholam. One time when she and Gavin had been hunting a sub-red white, they'd come upon a family that had fought the white briefly and chased it away. Through dinner, the father had acted strangely but denied he was hurt. The next morning he stood up and screamed. He'd taken a flame crystal in the groin. It had unmanned him, and ashamed, he'd hidden the injury. The flame crystal had cauterized, the wound closed, until infection made the skin burst apart when he stood, spurting blood and pus everywhere. He'd died, of course. They wouldn't have been able to save him even if they'd known. Looking at Zyman, she felt like that. Stomach diseased, like a grotesque pregnancy. 16 years of shame and failure had distended her belly, filled her with poison. Is not the one test of a mother how well she cares for her child? Caris had abandoned this boy. She'd not taken him once to her breast, hadn't even looked at him as if he were a monster, or worse, as if in looking at him she would love him. And now she was looking at him. And it was too late. Her heart was dead. Success, Caris. Your fears were unfounded. You are colder and harder than you knew. But the ache in her stomach only got worse. She couldn't look at Zyman. She needed her head in this, and it wasn't. She knew it was kind for Lord Spreadingoak to give her his seat, but she wished he hadn't. She felt exposed up here. People were looking at her as if they expected her to do something. They didn't know about Zyman, did they?
Child,
Hyluxiat Amazal repeated. He was looking at Caris. Now everyone was looking at Caris. Yes? She asked.
Please come forward.
She blinked, trying to remember what he'd been preaching about. She had no idea. Surely he didn't know, did he? Was he going to shame her publicly? For simply not paying attention? Surely not. She stood and moved forward with all the grace she could muster. The High Luxiat gestured her to stand in a place off to his left, but as Caris was walking, she saw a muscle twitch in Andros Gile's jaw. A wave of relief swept over her. She didn't know what was happening, but if Andros was angry about it, she wasn't about to be shamed. She took her spot and finally started thinking.
Ismini Krassos,
the High Luxiat said. A middle-aged noblewoman stood from one of the other front seats and walked up to a place beside Caris. From the row behind her, her horse-faced cousin, Aglaia, beamed with pride. One by one, the High Luxiat said the names of those seated in the front row, and each came to stand in line.
Eva Goldenbriar, Naftali Dalara.
Next would be Jason Jorvis, then Akensis Asmuth, and Croesus Tholos last. Caris knew them all, some from her time as a discipula, others only by reputation. All were drafters. Each was from either a prominent family or a formerly prominent one. Even she counted as the latter, she supposed. But she shouldn't be here with these people. And before the last name was even announced, Caris knew why they were here. She almost gasped aloud. Though if she'd been paying attention to the ceremony, it would have been obvious. But what was she doing here? If she had been putting together the lists, every seat was acceptable but hers. Drafters from the most important families among the satrapies that were still standing, with a special concentration on Hrothgar and Perea. Caris's seat should have been held by Malargos, but with Tisis gone it had reverted to Lord Spreadingoak, who was as weak a blue drafter as one could be and still passed the test. It was why he'd survived into old age. He never drafted, didn't see the need. They weren't here for a sermon.
Lords and ladies, Hyluxiat Amazal said, I present you with the cream of the seven satrapies. I present you with your finest, the seven candidates from whom Orholam will choose a new white.
The room broke out into applause, but it was a fierce, competitive applause. There were factions here. They were here to select a new white. The pool was selected by the Hyluxiats, but the white was selected by Orholam himself in a casting of lots. But Caris? What "There isn't always a grand design," the white had said. It was exactly the kind of wordplay she loved. It seemed a denial, but it wasn't one, was it? That there isn't always a grand design doesn't mean that there isn't a grand design this time. The white had been in discipula with Bran Spreadingoak, ages and ages ago. They were good friends. Bran deserved a seat at the front, but could be overlooked because he was so old. If he were made the white, he would only last a year or two, surely. Thus he became a nullity in Andros Gyle's plan, whatever that plan was. But by Bran's waiting until the ceremony was underway to vacate his seat and give it to Carys, there was nothing Andros Gyle could do about it. Then, moments later, they'd been locked in here. Not even slaves were allowed to come or go. The White had arranged for Carys to be here. All her tutelage was for this. The dozens of minor missions in years past, the possible suicide mission in Tyria, the slow takeover of the White's spy network, those tests that Carys had seen as so harsh, so unnecessary, were harsh and unnecessary for any position less than the White, which meant that the White had wanted Carys to be her successor. No, that thought was too grandiose, too arrogant, too presumptuous. And yet here she stood. The White had wanted Carys to be the next White. Perhaps Carys wasn't the White's only choice, though. 5 of the 7 standing here might be the White. But as Carys looked around, she was pretty sure that wasn't the case. That was Andros Gyle's kind of strategy. Buy everyone so whoever wins, you win. The White gambled differently. She put all her money on the long odds. Aurea Pelor had wanted Carys to be the next White. Carys's eyes started leaking. She couldn't stop it. That irascible old woman had even apologized for it beforehand. The White had been teaching Carys to take over all this time, and Carys had never seen it. That didn't bode well for how good of a White she would be, did it? We all have our blind spots. But pity her whose blind spot is a person. Carys had had 2, the White whom she'd underestimated but loved, and Gavin whom she'd underestimated and come to love when she stopped underestimating him. It was by Orholm's grace alone that both of her blind spots had been good to her. Carys had only 1 chance in 7 to fulfill the White's wishes, and suddenly she wanted it with half her heart. No one sane could want to be the White, but Carys could want Andros Gyle's puppet not to be the White. If she was the only stumbling block in his way, so be it. If it be your will, Orholm, use me. But how could she do it? Had the White been trusting Orholm to take Carys the rest of the way? And there it was again. A distant sound that made Carys's ears perk up. The first had been louder, but it had been buried under the rattling of the chains. A musket shot. There were multiple shots, muffled by the thick doors and thick stone, coming from another floor, perhaps? Or was she hearing the shots through the window? Was someone out on a balcony, several floors down, celebrating Sunday? It was, of course, forbidden to celebrate in such a way, but that didn't stop many people on Big Jasper. It did, however, usually stop people within the Chromeria itself. Carys looked over at the Black, who was seated in the second row, but Carver Black didn't appear to have heard the shots, or he was a better pretender than she'd ever guessed. Andros, on the other hand, Andros was the ultimate in pretense, in misdirection. Carys stared at him, though he shared the dais with her, and staring was obvious. What did she care? It wasn't like they could take away her candidacy because she was socially awkward. And then she saw it. She didn't know why this should be the first time. She'd seen Gavin operate 1,000 times 1,000, but Gavin had always been a special case. Now she saw power for what it meant to her. To her, it meant not just operating outside the social norms she always had. It meant flouting them. It meant staring at a man past the time it was acceptable to stare, and instead of feeling awkward, making everyone else feel it. That mastery, that freedom at the expense of others, was intoxicating. For one who had always had an affinity for the blue virtues of order and harmony, and setting a plate exactly according to some point book, written by some long-dead prince of the punctilious Pompasio, power was a revelation. Power not for others, but for her. And the heart of intoxication is toxic. Andros Gile looked back at her calmly. He didn't seem angry. It was a feeling, an intuition, rather than any hint of expression. He had an air of expectation, and an expectation for Andros Gile was an expectation of victory. He was patient because he was going to win. Caris smiled at him, smiled like she knew the game, like she loved that he thought he was going to win, smiled like she was better than he was. He blinked, then, the barest flicker of doubt. She ducked her head demurely and smiled on sweet secrets. He had a plan. Damn! Andros Gile wasn't a man to leave anything to chance. He wasn't going to take a chance, not even a 6-to-1 chance. Even if he owned all of the other 6, he would have a favourite. But how would he cheat? The ceremony must surely be designed to make cheating impossible. But Andros Gile knew exactly what those safeguards were. Or who. Caris looked at the High Luxiat Amazal. Was he part of it?
Orholum, Almighty Lord of Lords, he said, look upon us. Highest Lord and highest God, thee we beseech. Look upon our efforts and bless them with thy light, thy life, thy favour. This day, Orholum, Lord and High King, Emperor of Emperors, Balancer of Scales, mighty and just, honourable and pure, awesome in power, wholesome in mercy, we seek your will and not our own. We seek this day your white, your light, your antidote to night. We, your satrapies, ask your hand to rest lightly on us, lightly on obedient hearts that need only prompting, not compulsion, only guidance, for it is thy purpose which we seek to serve, and not our own. We praise thee, Lord of Lux Lords, Light of Nations, Voice in the Stillness, Guide to the Blind, and Path of Mercy to the Benighted. See and move, O God.
Each time he said God, he gave it the traditional moment of hesitation, of respect. It was a measure of his piety, or simply his experience, that he made the traditional seem vibrant, like he himself thought even this measure of respect was perhaps too little.
Candidates, he said, come forward. From this time forward, drafting is forbidden. Drafting is an imposition of our will upon the world. Any who draft, or who accept another's drafting on their behalf, will be disqualified and executed as a heretic. Understood? If so, repeat. Under the undeceivable eye of Orholum, I understand and I agree.
They did so, in unison. Then they followed him to a circle on the floor. Young Luxiats carried folding screens out for each of them and set them up quickly. Caris's Luxiat was a pimply, blushing young man of no more than 18. The High Luxiat spoke now only for their ears.
The ceremony must be unimpeachable. Thus, because in years long past others have attempted to destroy the sanctity of it, we have put safeguards in place. No lenses, no mirrors, no jewellery, no strips of cloth in your colour, nothing. Even your hair will be covered. In order to assure all that you are obeying these injunctions, you will strip, be searched, and be given identical garments, randomly assigned, all under the eyes of the blackguards, Luxiats, and each other. No exceptions. Even a white submits. If you object to these rules, you may remove yourself from consideration now. If you don't object now, and are found violating the rules, you will be executed by Orholum's glare. You understand?
They did.
If you think you see some malfeasance on the part of any other, bring it to the attention of the Luxiats. A new blackguard and Luxiat will be assigned to her or him, and she shall be searched again. Appropriate punishments will follow, by which I mean death for the heretic and the blackguard who allowed the heresy both.
He left, and Caris stripped down. Her blushing Luxiat was far more embarrassed than she was. Then he saw the bruising. Flopping into the river flat on her side had made the left side of her body look like she'd been dead, and lividity had set in. His mouth moved, but he was obviously forbidden to speak. Caris ignored it. Years with the Blackguard had stripped necessary nudity of its shame. Besides, feelings about her body would distract her from the game Andros was playing, and you couldn't play Andros and have any hope of victory if you didn't give it your full attention. The High Luxiat was facing 7 Blackguards. Each drew a number from a bowl and moved to one of the disrobing lords or ladies. Trainer Fisk, watch Captain Fisk now, moved to Caris. He gave her a shrug that barely moved his muscle-bound shoulders.
It was supposed to be women to search women, and men for the men. But with our numbers so low, they said, "Or Holm's beard, what happened to your..."
"Just do it," Caris said. He did. Not that there was much searching to do. Her hair took the most time, despite that it would be covered. Then he examined both of her hands, her eyes, her armpits, her back, her butt crack, the soles of her feet. Contraband was obviously the first target, but Luxin packing was the second. Fisk was a professional and moved quickly, his face a mask. 7 more Blackguards watched the searchers and the Luxiats, making sure nothing was passed between any of them. The randomness, assuming it was random, of the choice of guards seemed like it would defeat any plan Andros might try to orchestrate. Caris watched the others. She saw nothing other than their obvious discomfort. She wondered, would someone being passed a what, precisely? A coloured lens? A drafter would never go wrong with a lens. It would be small, inconspicuous, and allow lethal action. But she saw nothing untoward. Luxiats brought out stacks of robes, and at least 2 Blackguards searched each robe, bending seams to look for hidden pockets and shifting the piles randomly. The High Luxiat himself distributed them then, also seemingly at random. The robes weren't even different sizes, meaning Caris was swimming in hers while Jason Jorvis could barely close the robe. The High Luxiat came to each of them while they dressed, holding a plain wooden bowl.
"This is the order you'll draw," he said.
"We draw for the order we draw?" Caris asked, deadpan. He sighed.
"Would it shock you that there have been problems about precedence in the past? 1 goes first, 7 goes last."
Caris shrugged and drew. 6. She was secretly glad to be going so late. By then the choices would be constricted.
"There will be 7 stones presented. Listen for Orholm's voice. He will guide you. You each may bring no more than 1 stone back, just to warn you. Each has multiple layers of paint on it, and there is no way to tell how deep is the true one. You bring it back and plunge it into the bowl full of solvent. Whoever has the white stone will be revealed."
"What do you mean, we bring it back?" Caris asked. "Where are we going?"
"That's it?"
Jason Jorvis asked.
"No other rules?"
"You really don't remember?" Ismini Krasos asked.
"My family weren't on the Jaspers last time."
"And you didn't hear the stories?"
"I'm just trying to get the rules clear," he said.
All Caris could remember from the time Aurea Palor was selected as white was a boy named Amastan Niel, who'd stayed at a neighbouring estate for the summer. She had barely said 2 words to him in the whole time. Her best friend, whom Caris had told all about her crush on him all summer long, had kissed him the night before he left. It had been a devastating betrayal at the time. Last Caris had heard, Amastan Niel was now the 3rd largest exporter of wool in Perea. Somewhere in the tower, something rumbled. Something big. They all looked at each other.
"Was that part of this?" Caris asked.
But from the startled look on the High Luxiat's face, she knew it wasn't.
"We'll proceed," he said.
The Luxiats carried away the screens, and the candidates were brought to stand in a circle.
"Brace yourselves," the High Luxiat told the audience. "There is often a great deal of wind."
"Wind?"
At some signal Caris didn't see, all the windows in the room slid down into slots, even as the windows in Gavin's room, 1 floor above, did. There was a cold wind, but there wasn't much of it after the initial gust. The morning was still and warm. Then the floor shifted. Caris instantly dropped her centre and stood wide in a fighting stance. It was the floor beneath her and the other candidates. Ismini looked at her and grinned as if to say, "Isn't this exciting?" The 5-pace-wide circle on which they stood rose out of the floor, Patterns on the audience chamber floor sank, revealing tracks, and the entire disc the candidates were standing on started sliding toward the open window. "Am I the only one to whom this seems like a really bad idea?" Caris asked.
"Jump off, then," Jason Jorvis said.
She was standing right at the edge of the disc, and she had been considering doing just that, until he spoke. The disc slid out the window and into the air, supported on a vast arm protruding from the prism's tower 2 stories below. They slid out 10, then 20 paces from the side of the tower, and the great windows of the audience chamber rattled shut. Oh. Caris understood. Everyone was to see what happened, but no one was to be able to draft to affect the outcome. The nobles were craning their necks to see more clearly, but Caris's eyes were suddenly drawn up. Atop the prism's tower, one of the massive crenellations had split off and fallen several stories. That had been the rumbling sound she'd heard. The huge chunk of stone was dangling, suspended by woven steel cable. Caris had been atop that tower 100 times. There were no steel cables and massive bolts in the crenellations, and the precision of the break made it look purposeful. She was trying to see more of it. Where did that cable go? When her platforms shuddered again, 7 additional, smaller, circular platforms unfolded from beneath the larger platform. The 7 circles sank geared teeth into the edge of the larger platform and began wheeling slowly around them. Now, on each of the smaller circles sat a narrow pedestal, and on the pedestal, in teak and velvet, a white ball. They were identical. After they circled all of them once, they stopped. Naftali Dallara had drawn number 1. She said,
"No point in delaying, I suppose." She looked heavenward. "Orholm guide me. Orholm bless my choice."
She went to one of the pedestals and took the white ball there. Out on balconies of each of the 7 towers, a black guard and a Luxiat stood as a team, watching each other, watching the other teams and watching that no one would come out onto their balconies to interfere with the ceremony. But whatever cheat Andros had arranged was doubtless already done. He'd arranged who would pick and somehow told them beforehand which stone was the one. The mechanics of the cheating would never be visible, and in picking 6th, her choice would surely be moot anyway, a choice between 2 stones of which surely neither was the correct one. Pointless and barren, like so many years of her life. Eva Goldenbriar took longer, but settled on one in short order. The white had sacrificed Orholm only knew what to get Garrus here, and they'd lost. Caris didn't even know which smiling face hid a liar. Maybe all 6 did. Andros Gael always had backup plans behind his plans, didn't he? Caris heard musket fire again and could tell that it came from the top of the prism's tower. There were some few people gawking at the candidates through their windows, but no one was out on the balconies, and none was armed that Caris could see. What the hell was going on? The blackguards on the other towers looked alarmed too, but were glued to their stations. Akensis Asmith had selected his stone while Caris looked. Croesus Tholos took longer, hesitating a long time before one, praying, and then taking another. Then Ismini Krasos went. She looked at each of the 3 remaining for a long time, went back to 1 3 times, and finally picked it up. That left Caris and 2 stones. Listen to the will of Orholm, huh? She walked up to the 1st stone, white, round, small enough to fit comfortably in her palm. For whatever reason, it didn't feel right. Now that was odd. She approached the 2nd, studying it closely, and felt a strong urge to take it in her hand immediately. She crossed her arms. She'd claimed to the white that she wanted Orholm to speak to her in a way that was obvious, but here it was, and it was obvious, and she didn't like it. If Orholm's voice was a slap in the face, then of what value were Caris's ears? It somehow seemed to devalue her intellect. The intellect Orholm himself had given her. She should be a participant in Orholm using her. Shouldn't she? Or was she being arrogant? The fiery green-red drafter she had been not so very long ago would have made a decision, and to hell with it. Orholm could do his part or not. If this was his big plan, he'd have to do it. It was all probably pointless anyway, the correct stone already taken. But Caris wasn't that girl anymore. She had been foolish. She had done things for which she hated herself still. She'd tried to burn herself to ash and been too excellent to die. She'd tried to blot out the weakness with borrowed purpose as a blackguard. And now the ache and the disappointment were as much a part of her as her passion and her wildness. She was not a creature of isolated extremes, that disjunctive bichrome, not anymore. She was a whole cloth in the making, integrated. Ignoring the waiting nobles at the window and the waiting candidates around the disc, Caris turned toward the morning sun. The perfect fiery orb was losing its red tone as it rose, becoming gold. Caris spread bare arms, saluting the sun, soaking up its full spectrum light, accepting it and reveling in it. We are the stories we tell about ourselves. But when those stories are lies, we are the most surprised of all. When you ask for bread, Caris, would I give you a stone? And as she raised her arms, glorying in the light, she heard the sound of something huge giving way, and an enormous stone crenellation plunged right in front of her. With the sound of a whip unfurling, a line attached to that great stone spooled out, the other end strained over a pulley at the top of the prism's tower, and this stone plunged down and down. It hit the ground and plunged through it as if the ground had been designed to let it through, and it fell into the great underground yard under vast tension. At the same time, the steel cable unspooled out, away from the tower. It sprang free of the water between Big Jasper and Little Jasper. It tore right out of the top of the walls, ringing Big Jasper's east side, and then stood straining, tight, making a straight line from the top of the Chromeria almost to the docks. "Would I give you a stone?" Caris burst out laughing, and then as she turned, everyone was watching the great cable. She saw a flash of green at the corner of her eye. What? She looked at the horizon, but she knew, that the green flash only came at sunset. And then it hit her again. She looked toward Big Jasper. The star towers were spinning their mirrors, lighting up the crowds, festival, playful. One had caught the green tower and reflected it briefly to Caris. Caris laughed. She shook her head at Orholm, and then watched, stunned, as a young man went flying down the cable from the top of the tower. She thought she recognized him, but he was moving too fast. Cruxer? She went back to the stones. Her choice mattered. She knew, now, Orholm had not led her to a place where her choice was pointless. She looked at each in turn and again, felt drawn to one and repelled by the other. But she didn't touch either. Instead, she knelt by the pedestal on which one of them sat. She couldn't see anything there. She scratched a fingernail across it, and the tiniest shell of solid orange Luxin cracked and dissolved. And just like that, her feeling of desire to pick up this ball was gone. A hex. Magic forbidden with a sentence of death by Orholm's glare. But then, interfering with the choice of the white carried the same sentence, so there wasn't much added deterrent there. Andros, if it were Andros, had found an immensely talented orange drafter trained in forbidden arts, and had somehow defeated whatever security the Luxiats had and whatever checks were in place to make sure hexes were never placed here. But that was a problem for another day. Caris walked to the other ball, scratched her fingernail across the hex there and waggled a finger toward the window beyond which Andros Guile sat. Naughty, naughty. She picked up the ball. Some sixth sense warned her. Maybe the step of a running man beneath the sound of the wind and the musket fire still ringing out from the roof. Caris pivoted and dodged as Jason Jorvis closed on her. She was only saved because he went for the ball in her hand rather than simply trying to shove her off the tower. She spun with him, using his momentum against him to send him on toward the edge, but he snagged her weak left arm and pulled her with him. She broke his grip with a strong move that turned his wrist. He lost his grip but grabbed again, snaring the belt rope of her robe. He stumbled, one foot flying out over the edge, dropping his own white ball as he twisted back towards safety. The green in Caris hated to be bound. With one hand she whipped her belt rope from its two simple anchors at either side of her waist, while with the other she played out enough rope that Jason was tipping over the edge, totally dependent on the rope for balance. She heard more steps. The backup plan to the backup plan, of course. Everyone inside could see this, but there were no rules. Whoever came back with the correct ball was the white, and there would be no prosecution for murder. A fist went right through where Caris's head had been a moment before. Another punch, but this one she blocked with the white stone itself. As Akensis stood frozen with the pain in his shattered fist, Karis tossed the stone into the air. With her hand now free, she looped the rope into an open knot and flipped it over Akensis's hand as he watched the flying stone. Feeling the rope drape over his hand, he jerked away from her, pulling the knot tight. Karis dove, dropping the rope and rolled to her feet. She caught the stone. Akensis hadn't taken up the slack immediately, and so Jason Jorvis fell parallel to the platform they were on, but he kept his feet planted on the edge. It was an uncommonly smart move. Most people falling will panic and flail. Keeping his body tight, he gave himself a chance. Akensis pulled against the rope to save himself, screaming as the knot tightened on his wrist. He grabbed the rope with both hands and stood balanced precariously. For a moment, Karis thought about bringing them in. They were big men, though, heavy and strong. She was still forbidden to draft. It was the only rule. If she pulled them up, they would work together to kill her. With her left side injured, there was no way she could bring them both in. Would the others intervene? And if so, on whose side? How many would die to save these two traitors? There is a time for Orholm's gentle gaze, and a time for his glare. With a yell that was both dirge for her old life and rage that men would betray Orholm himself, and swelling pride that she knew all of her pain and training, and even her waywardness was being redeemed, Karis delivered the slippery side kick that was the pinnacle of Blackguard perfection. With such a kick, a small woman moving masterfully could launch a man into the air. And she did. Both men flew off the platform and plunged to their deaths. Everyone, silent, stared at Karis. The windows opened, and the disc slid back into its place inside. Karis dropped her stone into the clear bowl and didn't even watch the solvents do their work to reveal the stone's color beneath. She knew. Karis turned and addressed a stunned audience of colors and the Promarchos and the highest nobles in what remained of the seven satrapies. "We're at war," the new white said. "We're going to start acting like it."